Welcome to Disinformation Wars, a project of the American Foreign Policy Council. I'm AFPC Senior Vice President Ilan Berman. Disinformation Wars is a series of conversations with officials, experts, and practitioners designed to take you behind the scenes of the struggle for hearts and minds of global publics that's now taking place around the world. It's a contest being waged by Russia, China, Iran, and other actors, and the stakes could not be any higher. Among the most significant side effects of Russia's military aggression against Ukraine has been a dramatic tightening of the country's already unfree media sphere. For years, Russian journalists and commentators had suffered through a tightening web of restrictions on their work, as the government of Vladimir Putin made controlling the objective reality of ordinary Russians a major priority. Even so, the advent of the Ukraine war has been accompanied by extensive new constraints on acceptable speech within Russia, to the point that any coverage at odds with the Kremlin's official narrative, that the conflict is some sort of special operation to liberate the Ukrainian people, is now punishable by extensive prison terms. Additionally, a number of opposition outlets have been blacklisted as quote-unquote undesirable organizations under Russian law, which makes support for their activities, or even collaboration with them, tantamount to treason for ordinary Russians. The aggregate result of these measures has been an exodus of independent and opposition media from Russia. For the U.S. and its international partners, this dynamic is both a challenge and an opportunity. On the one hand, Russia is progressively becoming a black box from which it's increasingly difficult to extract information and where it's hard to accurately gauge internal political dynamics. On the other, the emptying of the Russian domestic media sphere has led to the formation of a new opposition media ecosystem in the West, one that has breathed new life into the Russian information environment. This network is still small, and it consists of just a handful of notable actors. One of the most important is iStories, an investigative media outlet focused on Russia's regions. I recently caught up with its founder and editor-in-chief, Roman Anand, to learn more about his work, the work of his team, and their vision for the future. Roman is a former reporter for the Russian newspaper Novaya Gazeta. He's the winner of three of the most prestigious awards in Russian journalism, and last year he won the European Press Prize Investigative Reporting Award for his investigation into the financial dealings of President Vladimir Putin's son-in-law. Roman was a member of the Panama Papers investigative team, which collectively received a Pulitzer Prize in 2017 for its coverage. Roman, wonderful to talk to you again. Thanks so much for coming on.
Sure, it's a pleasure.
Let's start at the beginning. Can you talk a little bit about the evolution of iStories itself? How and why did it start? What was the old mission? And how have things changed since the start of the war in Ukraine in February?
So before starting iStories in 2020, I worked as an investigative reporter for Novaya Gazeta for 15 years. At the beginning, I was a sports reporter. And then after covering the war in Georgia in 2008, I was moved to the investigative section. And I was the head of the investigations for more than 10 years in Novaya Gazeta. And as you probably know, four reporters and two members of staff of Novaya Gazeta were killed since 2000. And I mean, of course, journalism has always been not the safest profession in Russia. And honestly, I mean, I decided to become an investigative reporter after I heard the news that Anna Politkovskaya had been killed. And it was so interesting because we were not friends with Politkovskaya, because when I came to Novaya Gazeta, she was already probably the most well-known Russian journalist in the world. And I was just an intern of the sports section. But I remember that I was reading her pieces about the terrible atrocities of the Russian army in Chechnya. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, okay, stop writing these bad things about the Russian army. And it's interesting in terms of what I'm doing now, because I assume that there might be some people, some young journalists in Russia who are reading iStories and are thinking it's impossible. You know, the Russian army can't commit so many crimes. But here we are 16 years later, but we cover another war, a terrible war in Ukraine, and we investigate the atrocities of the Russian army. So iStories started in 2020 after I finished my fellowship at Stanford University. And it was an attempt to create what I was hoping to create, an ideal media, because, I mean, I loved Novaya Gazeta. It's my home, but still I wanted to create something own and something that's, I don't know, correspond with my expectations of the profession. And the idea was to create kind of a platform that would collaborate with other media outlets. So, you know, after working on Panama Papers and other cross-border investigative projects, I realized that the real power of journalism is not in competition, but in collaboration. And in the beginning, there were just nine of us, and we didn't even call ourselves a media outlet. You know, we called ourselves a project or a platform, whatever. But the idea was to kind of publish stories simultaneously with other media outlets, both in Russia and abroad. But of course, you know, the more we were publishing stories, the more the audience was growing. And at one point, the Kremlin noticed us and we became enemies to the state. And I think that it happened in December 2020, when we published the story about ex-son-in-law of Vladimir Putin, Kirill Shamalov. We proved that the guy, he bought shares of one of the biggest petrochemical companies in Russia for $100, and the shares were worth $400 million. And we got a leak from a source about that contained his emails. And, you know, that was a very big story. It was viewed by more than 3.5 million people on YouTube. And Vladimir Putin had even to comment on this story. And he said, I know the guys who published this story. They work for Western secret services. So whatever people in the CIA tell them, they read it. And I realized that we would have problems. Because if the president says that, you know, journalists are working for secret agencies, then his own secret agencies, of course, treat it as a command. So they have to prove that this is true. And I remember that I was talking to my ex-editor-in-chief, Dmitry Muratov, Nobel Peace Prize winner, and he told me, look, you have about 3 or 4 months and they will come after you. And he was right. So April last year, officers of FSB, the major Russian secret service, and officers of police of an investigative committee, they conducted searches in my apartment and in the office of iStories, and I had to leave the country because of the criminal prosecution. So the criminal case against me is still ongoing, but to be honest, on this stage is probably the smallest problems among those that we're facing. Because after the start of the war, we, as all Russian independent journalists, had this choice between three options. Either stay in Russia and stop our operations, because as you know, the Kremlin adopted a number of censorship laws, and even calling this war a war is a crime. You can be sentenced to 15 years of prison. The second option was to stay in Russia, continue your operations, and end up in jail, which actually some people made this choice, and I can admire their courage. But for us, it was obvious that it wasn't the best strategy, because while you're in jail, you can't report. So we choose the third option. We decided to relocate the newsroom and continue telling the truth to the Russian audience from exile. I wouldn't say that this is the best option, because I still believe that journalists should live in the country they write about. Otherwise, you know, you would lose the connection with the country, with people, and so on. But in our case, we didn't have that many options. And in the beginning, I thought that, you know, we made this decision actually at iStories. And in the beginning, I thought that, well, yeah, I mean, it's temporary, but what we gotta do? But only today, I actually realized it was the right choice, because during these 8 months, we were able to investigate and publish a number of really important stories. Some people say that we published probably the most important investigation during the war. We are the only media outlet not only able to describe some of the terrible war crimes committed by the Russian army in Kyivsky region, but also to talk to one of the soldiers who had confessed to us. He said that he had killed a civilian, and he even named us the name of the commander who had given him this order. And many others. We, in general, identified more than 15 war criminals, Russian soldiers who had committed concrete crimes. And not only that, I mean, we published many other stories. So today, from a kind of small media platform, we have transformed into one of the most important, probably, Russian media outlets during the war. I don't say the most important. I say just, you know, we are among the leaders. That's actually a big achievement of my team.
And I want to come back to that. I want to come back to the coverage that your organization and your team is doing and what stories you're uncovering. But you mentioned something first, which I want to drill down on. Your organization is part of a small ecosystem of opposition media outlets that are now operating outside of Russia, that have left as a result of government pressure or have made the choice to report from outside of Russia's boundaries. Talk about that new environment a little bit. Where does iStory fit in and what other major players are out there?
So on this stage, when I say that iStory is one of the leading Russian media outlets that is working from exile, on the one hand, yes, it's a big achievement of my team. On the other hand, well, it's because there are not so many Russian media outlets that are operating from exile. I would say that the major players are, of course, Medusa, probably the biggest online media outlet. Novaya Gazeta Europe, so it's ex-Novaya Gazeta. Dozhd, that was recently reborn. iStories, Mediazona, and actually, that is probably all. Of course, I don't mention terrific projects like YouTube channels of Navalny team. They do amazing work, but still they're not journalists. So these are the major media outlets. We all are different. Medusa is the biggest, and it mainly, I think that its target audience are young people from big cities like Moscow, St. Petersburg. Dozhd is, it's still early to talk about them because they have just started their work after they shut down their operations in, I think, March. As for us, what actually identifies us is that we try to reach the regional audience. So this is something that not so many media outlets do these days, because I believe that even when we started iStory, I told my team that, look, our job is not to conquer Moscow or St. Petersburg, because there are many allies in these cities, leaders who share our values. But our job is to try to reach those news deserts in Siberia, in Caucasus, and in other regions where the Kremlin, you know, just killed all the regional media outlets. And that's what we are trying to do. And actually, you know, of course, we had to face a lot of challenges, like our website was blocked and all other websites were blocked of the independent media. And we were wondering, okay, how we would reach this audience. And it was such a great lesson because, you know, we realized that we got to be flexible. So we understood that there are just two platforms that are still not blocked in Russia. It's Telegram and YouTube. And actually, on this stage, Telegram has become our major news channel where we share our stories, where we share the news, and it's even more popular than our website. Simultaneously, we had to develop our YouTube, even despite the fact that we are not video journalists. You know, I've never worked on TV. I'm a guy from a print newspaper, very traditional, actually, newspaper. But I had to learn video, because that was the best option to reach the bigger audience in the regions. And we're quite successful, actually. On this stage, we have 300,000 subscribers on our YouTube. And Dory, the investigation that I mentioned about the Russian soldier, was viewed by about 2 million people. But it's not the record. After that, we published a story about the relatives of the Russian soldiers who were killed in Ukraine. Soldiers from Buryatia, one of the poorest regions that is top in the list of people who died in Ukraine. Anyway, so we published a video about relatives of the soldiers, and it was viewed by 6.5 million people. And the most important thing is that 85% of these people are from the Russian regions. So 25% of Irkutsk, for instance, which is one of the biggest cities in Siberia, watched this video. So this is something that describes us, iStory, but it's just on the editorial side. Of course, if you ask any Russian independent journalist who is currently working from exile, how is he doing? I mean, we face a lot of problems. I mean, look, if you look at my newsroom, the majority of my reporters are young people, 23, 27 years old, and some of them don't even talk to their parents because their parents support the war. I just wanted you to kind of, so that you maybe get in the shoes for a while of these guys, so just you realize in what environment and in what context these people work. Not only people from iStory, but from other Russian independent media outlets as well. So these people, they had to leave their country, and they sometimes are hated by their relatives, even their parents, because their parents think that they are traitors because they don't support the war. These people, I mean, journalists, are hated by the majority of their citizens, of people who live in Russia, because as we know, the majority of Russians support the war. I don't want to go, I mean, we can talk about it, how many Russians in reality support the war, but still I think it's the majority. In many cases, these people, I mean, Russian journalists are not accepted in Europe or in other countries because, you know, people, many people in different countries, they don't care whether you're good or bad Russian. They just look at your passport. And if you are Russian, you will face problems. So it was such a big challenge to get visas, to get to legalize ourselves and to continue work and to increase the number of stories by 3-5 times, because we felt obliged, because we felt that this is our responsibility to work hard during the war. I'm just, you know, describing the context. I'm not complaining because I understand that our problems are just nothing in comparison, you know, with what people face in Ukraine, including my relatives, because ethnically I'm Ukrainian and, you know, my relatives actually come from Ukraine. So this is kind of the environment in which we operate.
And in terms of the stories that you cover and the investigations you conduct, they're very much focused on Russia's regions, as you said. So explain to me the value proposition here. Why are these so important in your estimation for getting a true sense of what's happening in Russia?
I mean, in general, the question is, why do we do this work since the majority of Russians support the war? And in particular, why do we want to reach the regional audience? And this is actually a very important question, because this is something we've been asking ourselves many times, because it's really difficult. I mean, it's easy to work when, you know, you feel the support from people. And I mean, when it's vice versa, when people actually think that you're a traitor, why then do you want to work for them? Why do you want to serve them? And here's our answer. First of all, we believe that currently 7 Russians out of 10 support the war. So we think that, you know, the proportion is 7-3. So first of all, these 3 people are very important, because Russia is a huge country. And I mean, you know, this 30% of people who don't support the war, we're talking about dozens of millions of people. It's a very important part of Russia. These are mainly educated people, entrepreneurs, developers, scientists, journalists, you know, and many others. And of course, these people, we receive dozens of messages, you know, from these people where they say, thank you so much for your work, because it's so important for us to feel that it's not something wrong with us. It's something wrong with the rest of people around us. And it's actually good not to support the war. It's actually okay to be against the state when state starts such a terrible war against the brotherhood country. So this is reason number one. Reason number two is that our work is important for the history. Sometimes, yeah, some people think that journalism is you know, we need journalism to change the world and make it a better place, which is true when other democratic institutions are working. You can't change the world with journalism if you don't have courts, if the legal system is not working, and in general, when the country is a dictatorship. But then there is a second very important kind of mission of journalism, is to save the history. So what we are doing now is we are really saving the history for future history books, both future history books in Ukraine, in other countries, and I hope in Russia. It's very important to save it for future generations so that they don't repeat our mistakes. Another third reason, why do we focus on the regional audience? I think that, you know, this proportion 7-3 is still changeable. I believe that our job these days, we got to look straight in the eyes of the truth. And of course, we can't say that, look, I mean, we'll publish these terrific stories and people will realize that war is so bad and they will start protesting and they will kick Putin out of his chair. That's impossible. But what is possible is to try to transform this proportion 7-3 to 6-4, because 6-4 is closer to half and half. And it's a very tough challenge, but it's real. I think that this is something possible. This is something that we can do. And in order to do that, of course, you got to target the regional audience. So that is why we pay so much attention to people in these news deserts. We believe that this is the only way you can actually change this proportion to something more real and more acceptable.
And from your vantage point, what's really taking place within Russia as a whole? We see a great deal of the official narrative that's being disseminated by the Kremlin. about patriotic support for Putin's war and about defiance of the Russian state against the West and so forth. But what's the real state of affairs within Russia currently, as you guys are seeing?
Well, I mean, it's complicated because it's such a big question, and Russia is such a big country. And of course, the mood is different in different regions. First of all, when I say that the majority of Russians support the war, of course, there are a lot of whys and a lot of hows. Not so many people actually are active supporters of the war, meaning that they really want this war to continue and they really want to destroy Ukraine. I would say that this is the minority. This is the worst minority of the country, mainly propagandists and people who are really poisoned by them. The majority that supports the war, they more like support, they are afraid to say no to the state. They really depend on the state. I don't remember the exact numbers, but I think that about 80% of Russians, they work either for the state directly or indirectly, meaning for the state-owned companies or companies that are owned by state companies. And of course, they are fully dependent on the state and they can't say no. And in general, the mood that is ruling Russians is actually not the aggression, it's apathy. People really don't want to do anything. And they really, when you talk to them, what you hear hidden behind their words is like, please let us alone. Please let us live our life without all these problems. Because people in regions are really poor. You know, Russia is a really poor country. People take loans to buy pills. People take loans to buy stuff for their kids so that they can go to the school. And of course, people don't have any time, energy, and will to think about what their country is doing in Ukraine and in general, where Russia is going as a country, where Russians are going as a nation. I think it's actually changing now a bit because of the war, and this apathy is actually going away, and more people are starting to ask questions, you know, what are we doing? What is the future? What will be the future of my kids? And it's a very, really bad news for the Kremlin. I don't know what will be the reaction. I mean, I can only assume. I think that, you know, Putin can't win the war with Ukraine, but he can win the war with his own population because he doesn't care. I mean, if he's a maniac, if he needs to kill hundreds of thousands of Russians during the protest, he will do it. He will do it because he's a coward who is really afraid to lose the power. Then another important thing is that we underestimated the power of propaganda, including me. I didn't know that propaganda is so powerful. I thought that, you know, propagandists are actually working, they are serving themselves and the Kremlin. I thought that the majority of people don't listen to the stupid stories about secret laboratories started by Americans in Ukraine, about, you know, these military mosquitoes, about military pigeons and so on. But I underestimated it because propaganda, as it's kind of obvious these days, is like radiation. Once you're poisoned, it's really difficult to get rid of it. And in the beginning of the war, we published, I think, a really important story that was based on a number of scientific researches that showed that if a person is already infiltrated by propaganda, there is almost nothing you can do. The only way to fight it is what we call to give people this vaccination of truth. So the research, actually, the scientific data shows that if a person knows the truth before he sees propaganda, he's less likely to be indoctrinated by propaganda. That is why it's also so important to kind of to target the younger audience, the younger generations of Russians, so that they receive this, you know, vaccine, the truth vaccine from propaganda.
So where do we go from here, based upon what you're seeing and based upon precisely this dynamic of the spread of propaganda? What's your vision for Russia and for your craft for informing Russia?
I think that the very first step is to help Ukraine win the war. I think that Russia will not change. I mean, everything even will worsen if Russia wins the war. I think that this is the start of the changes in Russia is in Ukraine. Putin has to lose this war. Russians will then understand, hopefully will understand, what a terrible mistake, what a tragedy was actually happened because of them. Russians and Russia in general needs to rethink its past and its future. It needs to rethink its Soviet past, because the crimes of the Soviet regime were not properly analyzed. And what we see actually today in Putin's rhetoric and his ideology, in many ways, it actually comes from the Soviet propaganda. And of course, we should make the point in the Soviet history, and we should condemn the crimes of the Soviet regime. I'm actually, you know, all of the families, all of the Soviet families somehow suffered from these crimes. My grandpa, he spent almost 15 years in Gulag. He was imprisoned when he was, I think, 18 for just, he didn't want to sign a fake letter against the director of the plant where he was working. And, you know, just because he wanted to remain honest, he spent his best years of life in prison. So, of course, this is the first step. Ukraine should win the war. Russia should rethink its past. And also, of course, its future. Russians need to understand that without democracy, without democratic values, without democratic institutions, and when I say democratic institutions, you know, when I talk about democratic institutions, I mean courts, I mean law enforcement, I mean media, I mean human rights. So without that, the development of the country is impossible. And I think that it's a very long process. I don't think it's going to happen soon, maybe not even during my life, but this is the only way. Otherwise, Russia will just disappear the country. I don't mean that, you know, it will split in different territories. No, I don't mean that. But I mean that inside the country, we might witness actually a civil war. And this is something that experts and people who live there are now talking. You know, in the beginning, it sounded like it's a crazy idea. Today, more and more people talk about it. And in the beginning, people were talking about so-called cold civil war in Russia. And today, even the best political experts are already writing stories and thinking about a real civil war between different clans for the power after Putin. So, you know, Russians should make a choice whether they want to remain the country of a civilized world, or they want to disappear from this map of civilized countries and actually lose their opportunities forever.
And that brings us, I think, to the role of the West. In the past, media outlets like yours have shied away from support from the US and from Europe for a host of reasons. But most of all, I think, because accepting assistance from the West made it easier to be discredited by the Kremlin. But as you pointed out, that's really not relevant anymore. So in this new ecosystem that's emerging in terms of Russian exile journalism and investigative reporting, what's the proper role? What's the optimal role for Western countries to play?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question, because yes, we have to admit that there are no any business models in Russia, and it's even funny to discuss. And of course, all the independent Russian media outlets that are operating from exile are dependent on the support from various institutions, from donors, actually, either, you know, private or state-related donors. So this is something that we have to admit, and it's not our choice. iStories, for instance, was quite successful in crowdfunding. Medusa was quite successful in crowdfunding. It was a sustainable media outlet. But then the Kremlin, you know, ruined all the models. And on this stage, we're dependent on the support from the West. I think that it's something that Western institutions should continue this support, because Russian independent media outlets are important for the Russian audience. You know, the Russian audience will not trust Ukrainian media. The Russian audience will not trust the Western media. The Russian audience will only trust the Russian media. And that is why I think that it's so important to continue the support of the Russian independent media that is operating from exile. Simultaneously, it's really a good idea to set up a number of institutions, or, I mean, to use those that already exist, kind of independent institutions, non-for-profits, either in the US or in Europe, that don't belong to the state, that have their own kind of control from the supervisory board or the board of directors or whatever, so that those institutions distribute the money, distribute the support from the Western countries, and they know the editorial policy of the media outlets, so that this kind of support is not coming from the state, where the state is saying, look, we want you to write this number of stories. This is something that is actually not happening right now as well. But I mean that maybe creating such institutions is a good idea. And I know that there are such initiatives, for instance, Muratov and Maria Ressa, Nobel Peace Prize winners, they are trying to set up an institution, a fund for international media outlets that are working from exile. It's not only Russia, you know, it's other countries as well, like Venezuela, like Nicaragua, and like Syria and others. And maybe such a fund is a good idea.
I think that's a very important insight to end on. So Roman, thank you for taking the time. Thank you for sharing the information about your work and your vision for Russia.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you for tuning in to Disinformation Wars. To learn more about the American Foreign Policy Council and our work on public diplomacy, visit us online at www.afpc.org. And as always, we hope you'll join us again next time.